make the front of the line in the United States, and a lot of mad people.
Well, have a safe trip home. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the sixth case, United States versus Height, Mr. McGowan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the court, counsel? My name is Andrew McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case, William Height. After jury trial, Mr. Height was convicted on two counts of possessing a revolver without a serial number and a .22 rifle with too short a barrel. This possession occurred on February 14, 2001. He raises two issues in this appeal. I'm going to address the first one unless there are questions about the second one. And I will jump immediately to the question under Rule 403, which addresses whether the evidence that we're objecting to, whether its probative value was substantially outweighed by its prejudicial effect. And in this case, the evidence that we're objecting to in count one is the evidence by an ex-girlfriend that 2 years before this alleged possession on confirmed by conviction on February 14th of 2001, that she saw him with these two guns, and in fact with one of them, he performed what I would consider a functional equivalent of Russian roulette. And in fact, her account was that he did perform Russian roulette. The district court redacted the information to some extent, but our position is that the district court did not redact it enough.
She testified live at trial, I assume.
Yes, she did. She had testified live at trial that she saw him with the gun, that he opened up the revolver part of it, and then that was one bullet. He spun the chamber and pulled the trigger a few times, I think, was her testimony. And I think
the jury did know she was an ex-girlfriend. But
the jury did know that. We were restricted, in fact, in cross-examining her because the court did, as part of its ruling, say, well, if you examine too closely her ability to recall this event, you were opening the door to the full account. I believe we asked maybe one question or two about the fact that she was the complaining witness in a domestic dispute that Mr. Height was, in fact, I think, on probation for while this alleged possession was taking place. I can't think of a clearer case, really, for the prejudicial effect of this evidence. The government's case didn't include anybody else saying that they saw him with the gun. Admittedly, the gun was in his bedroom. The guns were in his bedroom. But I just think that the cumulative effect of this evidence would lead almost anyone to conclude that Russian roulette was involved, even though the court redacted to some extent the testimony. The test in this case is whether it was probative. You look at the probative value, and I think that because we're not objecting to the fact that she saw the gun, that she saw him with it, that she saw that it was loaded, that she saw him use it, we think the probative value of this evidence is very limited. However, the prejudicial effect is very strong. It's strong enough that we think it overcomes the harmless error rule on that fact alone.
What did the testimony about this Russian roulette speak to? I mean, the judge precluded the suggestion that it was pointed at her, right?
He excluded that.
So, is it a classic Russian roulette situation, or is it just that he had a gun, spun it? I mean, is he pointing at the wall? What happened at trial, I guess?
What happened at trial was she was allowed to testify to what I said. She also was allowed to testify that she was concerned. Now, classic Russian roulette is you're using it on yourself for whatever reason. I've never really understood Russian roulette myself. However, it can be used to incite fear in somebody else. Here is a guy who's really crazy, who doesn't know what he's doing, and I better do what this person says. I mean, this comes up in movies, I think, more often than anything.
So her testimony was that he had, in effect, pointed it at himself?
No, she didn't testify at all. The problem with this evidence is that she got to testify that he pulled a trigger of a loaded gun in a house of some sort.
Right.
A residential house. And I thought that that was the main problem in the first place. And I still do, and that's what I brought up to the district court. However, you know, on reviewing this, it's just the conclusion is inescapable that he was playing Russian roulette. The jury was left to decide whether he was doing it to himself or her. There was really no evidence to indicate what he was doing because she was on there relatively briefly. And she did restrict her testimony to what the district court allowed her to testify to. But it's just very, very prejudicial, and it allowed the jury to convict him on something other than what he was charged with, which is the problem under 403.
Was there any discussion about stipulating to the fact that she saw the weapon in his possession 2 years earlier?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, but there was.
It's not in the record, Your Honor.
The problem was the original information we had was from a police report where she looked at a picture and indicated that she thought it looked similar. Well, something 2 years before, I argued that it wasn't relevant. Then it turns out that her testimony was that the guns were the same. And in that event, and that's why on appeal we're not objecting to the fact that she saw him with the guns, that is relevant. But the rest of the evidence is just beyond the pale. We are raising also a legal question about whether this is inextricably intertwined or 404B. Of course, the analysis under 403 applies in either case, but I would like to address the government's argument that your review of that question, whether it's 404B or inextricably intertwined, is abuse of discretion as opposed to de novo. We cited a Ninth Circuit opinion, which appears to be the only circuit to really address this issue. Even in the cases the government cited, it doesn't appear as though the circuits have actually addressed this particular question. I would submit it's a question of law. There's no reason for this court not to review the question of whether it's 404B or inextricably intertwined as a question of law. And we would submit that it would be appropriate for the circuit to take that approach. Notwithstanding that, we believe that the district court did err in concluding it was inextricably intertwined. The essence of our argument for this is that it's 2 years later, 2 years before, I should say, the event that he's charged with. This is a possession case. He's charged with possessing on a particular date. 2 years before just seems to be outside the time frame of inextricably intertwined. The words themselves indicate something close. The cases support the idea that the event is close in time to the charged event. The government cited 404B cases and suggested that you should be able to tack on the time limit under 404B for this 403, this inextricably intertwined analysis. But the government doesn't supply any support for that. And I would submit that under just the definition of inextricably intertwined, it wouldn't be appropriate. The government hasn't cited any cases, I don't think, that are outside of the, say, 4 month time frame between that the courts have found are inextricably intertwined. Your Honor, if there are no more questions, I will reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eugene Miller. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Central District of Illinois, and I handled this matter in the trial court. As an initial matter in the standard of review, as we've cited in our brief, the United States believes that the appropriate standard of review as to whether evidence falls under 403 or under 404B is an abuse of discretion standard. We've cited the cases, Gibson and Roberts, both in this district, where they discussed whether evidence was intricately related, inextricably intertwined. Those terms are used interchangeably. And they addressed that under an abuse of discretion standard. We've also cited other circuits, 8th, 10th, and 11th, that also have at least addressed it in an abuse of discretion standard. The Ninth Circuit case cited by defense counsel does hold that it's a de novo standard of review of whether it falls under 404B, but a reading of that case suggests that there's no discussion of the question in that case either. It simply concludes that it's a question of law, and therefore a question of law is reviewed de novo. for the same reasons that the cases discuss abuse of discretion, those reasons being that a trial judge is in the best position to evaluate the evidence in the context of the case based on his familiarity of the case and his ability to gauge, his or her ability to gauge the overall impact of the evidence in the context of the case. For those same reasons, the trial judge is in the best position to determine whether certain evidence is intricately related to the charged crime. And therefore, we believe that the United States would submit that abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard. And under that standard, of course, the defendant faces a heavy burden. The standard requires that no reasonable person could take the view of the trial court. And in this case, the trial court held an extensive hearing and took extensive time in determining the appropriate amount of information to allow the jury to hear based on the testimony of Patricia Stewart. And there was a proffer made that she would testify in this case, that she saw the identical gun that the defendant at trial was denying that he was in possession of, even though it was found in his bedroom while he was present. And the United States proffered her testimony, which was that she had seen him with that identical firearm approximately 2 years earlier. And part of that testimony was based on the fact that she was able to describe that firearm and could identify that firearm because of the context in which she saw it. It wasn't simply that she saw him with it in her hand. It was that he had taken that firearm and played what is commonly called Russian roulette, that he had taken it, he had pointed it to her head or face area, showed her that there was a bullet in it, closed it, spun the chamber, and pulled the trigger several times. And it, based on that incident, she was able to recall what the gun looked like. In fact, that she wouldn't forget what the gun looked like. And we offered at trial, and the judge listened to the argument, that that was important to support her testimony regarding the fact of her ability to recall the firearm, her ability to recall this incident several years later, a couple of years later. Important because it showed, in fact, even that the firearm was a revolver. There was testimony from a defense witness. He referred to it as a pistol. It was a revolver in this case, and it corroborated her testimony that, in fact, it was a revolver. And as the trial court found, that's much more than just testifying that she saw him with it in his hand as to his knowledge of the firearm, how it worked. As we stated in our brief, we have to show his knowledge of the firearm, the non-conforming characteristics, obliterated serial number. It's much more likely someone's going to be aware of the characteristics of that firearm if they know how to use it.
One of the facts that focused her attention on the firearm was the fact that he pointed at her face, I assume, and pulled the trigger, but that wasn't before the jury, though, right?
That's absolutely right, and this court always hesitant to read testimony, but her testimony was so brief in this case. There's 7 minutes in total testimony in this case, including cross-examination and everything in the context of the two-day trial, that we suggest that the trial court did got it precisely right when it tailored her testimony. It did not allow any of that testimony, and we respectfully disagree with defense counsel's characterization that the Russian roulette testimony was before the jury. And in fact, I set that testimony concerning this incident out in the brief because it's so short. She was asking, what were the circumstances by which you saw Government Exhibit 5, which was the revolver? She said he had it in his hand. And what did you observe about Government Exhibit 5 when he had it in his hand? He showed me that there was a bullet in the chamber, spun it. Let me stop you there. How did he show you there was a bullet in the chamber? He opened up the chamber and showed it to me. And then what? He spun the chamber and pulled the trigger a few times. Now, was a shot ever fired? No. Did this cause you any concern? Yes. Did he stop pulling the trigger? Yes. And why did he stop pulling the trigger? I convinced him to stop. At least, I think a fair reading of this, and in the context of the very short testimony at trial, was that he showed her the revolver, that there was a bullet spun in the chamber and pulled the trigger a few times. There was absolutely no testimony, because the judge precluded any such testimony, that the gun was pointed at her or at any other person. And in fact, it's hard to call this other crimes evidence because the testimony that was presented to the jury at trial really didn't present in and of itself a crime. The testimony was presented for the limited purpose and the proper purpose of establishing that this defendant had the intention and the power to have control over that firearm on the date of the charged offense. And it also showed his knowledge knowing possession of the firearm in that he had possessed it before, and his knowledge of the non-conforming characteristics of the firearm because of the way that he had used the firearm. And again, the district court took pains to make sure that only appropriate information was before the jury. And we should know, as far as the analysis goes, between whether it was unfairly prejudicial, because certainly it was prejudicial as any information that tends to implicate the defendant is, the court gave an appropriate limiting instruction, in fact, one that was ultimately suggested and agreed to by the parties as to how this information could be considered by the jury. The United States believes that the district court did not abuse its discretion in that respect. And as far as the question of whether it falls under 404B or 4043, it's interesting in this case, in looking at it, really the ultimate result, it's somewhat irrelevant as to which approach was taken. And I say that because if you look at the four prongs of 404B, of course the fourth prong is whether the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, which analysis the court undertook under 403. As far as the other three elements go, the second and third, defense counsel concedes in his brief, this evidence qualified, that the evidence supports the jury finding that the defendant committed the offense. The direct eyewitness testimony of Patricia Stewart certainly sufficient to do that, and also that it was similar enough and close enough in time to be relevant, and the defendant has conceded that in the brief, that it was the identical revolver, and it was close enough in time to be relevant. That means the only other question is whether it addressed an issue other than propensity. And of course, the district court explicitly found that it did under 403 when it found that it was intricately related, because it made findings that this evidence directly tended to prove that the defendant had the power and intention to exercise control over the firearm, and that the defendant knowingly possessed the firearm. So really, whether it's under 403 or under 404B in this case, it doesn't matter, because prongs under each standard were found by the district court and have been met. So the United States does believe that the district court got it right. And for those reasons, the United States requests this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. If there are no further questions, I'll return the balance of my time.
Thank you, sir. Mr. McGowan.
Your Honor, I believe it does make a difference whether it's under 404B or any strictly intertwined, otherwise I wouldn't be arguing it. I don't think the government can meet its burden under the first prong, which is to show that it's something other than to prove propensity to commit the crime. I say that for a couple of reasons. First of all, the non-conforming aspect of this gun was that it didn't have a serial number on it. The woman testified, I believe it was proffered, or maybe she testified that she didn't see whether it did or not. Of course, that was 2 years before. This is an obliterated serial number. Who knows when that happened? Second of all, the reasons that the government proposed that it needed to introduce this evidence was to show that it intended to that he intended to exercise control of the firearm. Well, you know, he's holding it, he's showing it to her, you've got that. To show not that it was his possession was not due to ignorance, mistake, or accident. Again, he's holding it, according to her testimony, 2 years before. You know, you take that for what it's worth. The rest of the information is unnecessary.
So it's the spinning and the pulling of the trigger, you say, that pushes it over the line?
I believe so, Your Honor. And I don't even know that the spinning would do it if there were no other evidence about her concern. All I'm looking at is the evidence of his pulling a trigger in a house. And the rest of it, like I said, would lead any reasonable person to conclude at
it
some point that Russian... I beg your pardon?
What'd you see? It would be what?
Pulling the trigger in the house would be what?
Pulling the trigger in the house is bad enough.
Yeah.
I mean, you get jurors who are thinking about their own family, boyfriends coming over with guns, you know, pulling triggers with a loaded gun in their house, and all of a sudden it's, who cares about whether he possessed it on this day? This guy needs to be punished. And that's the kind of problem that this case raises. But that would be bad enough. But in this case, you've got this initial evidence that could lead them to prove, to conclude that he was actually playing Russian roulette.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Mr. Miller, case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.